So I thought I'd like to just sort of say a little bit about why energy is considered to be one of the three principles of the enlightened mind. So I've already said we get wisdom, compassion and energy as the three aspects of, or principal aspects of the enlightened mind. Or in a way, it means that you can look at it from either of those viewpoints. So a bit like I was in three minds, like a tree in which there are three blackbirds. Yeah, a bit like Wallace Stevens thinks. So it's not two, which would be, but there's three. So, and in a way, perhaps it's fairly obvious why we can look at enlightenment as compassion or love. So we have this idea that one way the path can be achieved in a sense by just fully opening the heart, yeah? If we manage to just fully open the heart, this might well be equivalent to what's called enlightenment. The heart is open both ways, by the way. I think we open the heart as an organ of perception. So it's not just that we're fully in the world, it's that the world is fully in us. So this, when we talk about opening the heart, it's more that we're opening the heart to the world, if that makes sense. So the world comes into us, the world is fully in us and we are fully in the world. And another way of it's looked at is through wisdom, but this third way of energy is perhaps a little bit more difficult to understand. And I'm not sure that I can really explain it. And there's a good way, there's a good reason why I can't really explain it to you. Because Vajrapani, and the way of Vajrapani, if you like, it sort of constitutes, in fact, in Tibetan Buddhism, his family, the Vajra family, all these different figures, they belong to different families. And in the Tantra, originally, the Buddha family was dominant, was the primary family. But over time, the Vajra family, Kshobhyo is the main Buddha. He's a blue Buddha, and Vajrapani is a kind of reflex, or a sort of action, the action aspect. And his wisdom is a mirror-like wisdom, actually. And anyway, the Vajra family became dominant. They became central to the whole thing. That's why it's called the Vajrayana, the way of the Vajra. So Tibetan Buddhism is the way of the Vajra. It's the way of energy. It's the way of the lightning or the diamond thunderbolt. Yeah. And this is the energetic way. And what this implies is that it's a way, a full-bodied way. Yeah, it's not just mental. It's not just love. It's full-bodied. It involves all of us. And predominantly, it involves us energetically. And the Lakshana, all these different things, they all got these different correspondences. So there's a particular Lakshana associated with this way, and it's a Lakshana of impermanence. So this means that the stepping into the fact, if we can call it a fact, stepping into the full nature of impermanence is the Vajra way, is the diamond way. Yeah? To really take on the things that are impermanent. And they also have a door, and the door to step in, that we have to step through to step into impermanence, the Dharma door, is known as the signless door. Yeah, the signless door. So this explains why I can't really explain it to you, because what this means is that this way is beyond any conceptualization, yeah? It can't be conceptualized. So it means for you, stepping beyond, not for you, for all of us, which includes you. It means stepping beyond any conceptualization that you might have, any idea that you might have. It's all got to go. It all goes. So this is a sign. So it's rather difficult for me to explain conceptually. I can't really explain it to you conceptually. You can kind of get a sense of it through looking at the figure, perhaps. That it's trusting something else. It's trusting something else in you. It's not trusting your ideas. It's not trusting your ego. It's not trusting your cleverness or your intelligence. It's trusting something else. And so it's kind of having a... It's more of a sensation or a feeling way of being in the world. It's sort of spontaneous. It's sort of uninhibited and spontaneous and a little bit wild in a way. A little bit crazy sometimes when you just really trust something. You kind of are prepared to step out into the unknown. Yeah? And we all get this feeling sometimes, don't we? And quite often we pull back from it. And so in that sense, I mentioned in the meditation, Vajrapana is very much associated with fearlessness, this need to cultivate or come into your fearlessness, which is only done through fear, funny enough. It's like the healing through the wound, if you like. To really overcome fearless, to become fearless, you have to accept how frightened you are. When you really step into your fear, you become fearless in a way. When it's very interesting, I've been privileged enough to sit with and be with and know quite a lot of people that have died. And some of those people have had, you know, a couple of years to get used to the idea. Some of them have died quite quickly. I used to work in a hospice. And I've seen this a lot with people. Actually, we spend our life worrying. And very often, at root, our anxiety, which gets displaced into being obsessive about keeping the house clean or whatever it is, you know, it gets displaced. But actually, at root, very often, that anxiety, that kind of anxious state we've got going on, very often, actually, at the root of it is death. So all Buddhism and actually, you know, lots of philosophical systems realize that you have to come into relationship with death because this is your big fear. And actually, of course, this is Vajrapani's realm, impermanence. This is his way, is to come into relationship with impermanence. And it doesn't just mean noticing the leaves dropping off the trees in autumn or the blossom. It means that you're going to die. Yeah? And to come into relationship with this. And as I said, I've been lucky enough to see actually what happens when people do come into relationship with their own death. And usually, not always, because some people, even when they have the diagnosis, even when they're told they've only got a few months or a few weeks or a few days to live, can't do it. They can't do it. And they don't die so well. Yeah. But when they do come into relationship with it, paradoxically, they blossom. They just open. It's a very beautiful thing to see people. Yeah? But you don't have to wait for that, really. That's what Vajrapani is about, in a way. This thunderbolt of his, this Vajra of his, is about destroying obstacles. It's about getting rid of anything that's in your way that's stopping you fully open. And actually to open to beauty is also this opening to death. Yeah? To open to impermanence is to open both to the beauty, the exquisite nature of this world, and also to open to your own mortality. This is what we're doing. And this is his wisdom in a way. This is his way. It's this fearless way. In this way, it's the way of a warrior. His pose is that of a warrior. Anyway, much, much more could be said about Vajrayana. As I say, he is a very interesting figure historically, but I'm not going to go into that tonight. But he's just to say, he's associated right back. He's the oldest of all the Bodhisattvas. He's right back in the Pali Canon, right back at the beginnings of Buddhism, with the historical Buddha. He's often shown on his left side with a sort of club, and in this, he's just a sort of yaksha, what's called a yaksha at this point, a nature spirit, and he's shown as a very sort of muscular, hairy guy, usually with a big sort of club, protecting the Buddha. And just one story out of many, the Buddha had a cousin, Devadatta. Devadatta, interestingly enough, was the most skilled of all the Buddha's disciples in the psychic arts. He could, so the story goes, he could actually transform himself into animals. He could read people's minds. He could manifest in different places. He was psychically the most advanced of all the Buddha's followers. But he was, according to legend, he was evil, which is quite interesting. And he was jealous of his cousin, the Buddha, and he wanted to kill him. And there's this incident where the Buddha's sitting there meditating, and Devadatta was supposed to cause somehow, I can't remember how he did it, but he literally pushes it off, maybe just psychically, caused this big boulder to come down this hill behind the Buddha to crush him. And just as it was about to hit him, Vajrapani steps in front of the boulder and splits it in half, and the boulder just falls harmlessly either side of the Buddha. And at that point it said that the Buddha made Vajrapani the protector of the tantras. So this is according to later Buddhism. The tantras were teachings that the historical Buddha didn't give in his lifetime, but came out later. Anyway, you can make it that way you want, but it doesn't matter, that's a legend anyway. So he's also, Vajrapani is also this protective figure, and it's particularly useful, it's said, when if you're ill or facing some very difficult time, you invoke, you chant Vajrapani, it gives you courage and fortitude and clears your path, removes obstacles. But be careful, because he's removing obstacles to coming into a relationship of impermanence, yeah. So you sometimes get more than you bargain for with this sort of thing, yeah. It's not necessarily what you think you're going to get. But you get what you need, perhaps. Anyway, that's enough. I hope that gives you a little bit of a flavour of Vajrapani. He's surrounded by flames there. He has, and this is quite common, showing with this sort of complete flames all around him. And he's got a tiger skin around his middle. Okay, so we're going to do a little bit more meditation. We're just going to do some very simple, basic energy work. And again, just so I want to sort of try and give you a sense of how, as a meditator, you can work more energetically than mentally. I think people that sort of try and stop their thoughts or try and do stuff with their sort of mental, it's a hard way to meditate. It's a tough way to meditate, and it's not necessary, you know. Just let them do what they want. You know, they're not so interesting usually, actually. And I think it's a very, very sort of tough way to meditate. And as I alluded to very briefly, I think we're a bit obsessed with the mental aspect of meditation, because in our culture we're totally obsessed with that part of ourselves. This is a cultural thing. It's not always been like this. We think it's how it is to be a human being, but it isn't, honestly. Not all human beings, not through history, they haven't all been so obsessed with their thoughts and their ideas and this mental. They used to be a lot more tactile and smelly and tasting and feeling the world, you know. They were a lot more in the world as this place of texture and smell and animals and, you know, a lot more from the heart as well, you know. Because it's the heart that knows how to hunt, actually. It's instinctual. When we depended on our instinct, we had to be a lot more in our bodies than we are now. And this movement out of the body towards the head has also affected how we think of meditation. We think it's about controlling or changing our thoughts, or kind of a bit obsessed. And it's a difficult way, you know. It's an aspect of meditation, but it's a difficult way to meditate. So when we started thinking, well, maybe we can meditate more energetically. It's a lot easier way to meditate, yeah? Anyway. And it's based, as all meditation is based, on the breath. And this is because the breath is our most direct access to the energetic body. Yeah, so let's start by being in the world. This is the first thing when we meditate. Sometimes when we meditate, we think we want to be in our own little private world, but there's no private world. We live in the world, yeah? And actually, one last thing I want to say. Vajrapani is rather good about... One of the reasons we sometimes have a very difficult time in life is that we can't synchronize our energy with the energy of our environment. And this makes it very difficult. If you're living in a city like London, you have to have a certain sort of energy to be able to cope with it. You can't be just sort of all floppy and pastoral. It doesn't really work, yeah? You've got to have a certain sort of vigour and vitality to cope with a city like this, you know? So, you know, Vajrapani is also quite good for that. It gives you a bit of a kind of energy you need to be in an urban environment. So we're in an urban environment, and let's just acknowledge that. And there's lots of wonderful things about this city. It's wonderful, has its problems, but you know, it's a fantastic city to be in. What a fantastic place. We can just have a sense of it. River Thames, going right back. Romans. And before. We just have a sense of it all around us. It's the different cities that have been on this ground. There used to be a race course just down the road at Notting Hill. There used to be a race course down there. The underground rivers, there used to be the Ladbroke that's been put underground. There's rivers, there's lots of rivers in London running underground. A sense of what's around us, and all those lives, all those millions of lives going on. And then lights and the cars and the people and the pubs and the restaurants and the houses. It's a the sense of all that life, all that human life, and even in that human life there's still loads of bird life, loads of birds, loads of foxes, loads of dogs and cats. That's wonderful. London plane trees. All that other life still manages to exist in this city. The sense of all that life around you. And here we've got this lovely, relatively quiet place in the heart of this city. In the room. Candlelight. Other people. Some sense of sitting in this room, the earth below you, sky, go right through the building, just shoot up through the building and find the sky above your head. It's always there. Nice soft face. And just come into our natural breath. So we're going to imagine, along with our natural breath, our normal breath, we're going to just imagine, and this is a light imagining. So when we do this sort of work, we never try and force it. We never try and be too willful. It works better if we're just playful. Try and remember when you were a young child, when you were young, 4 or 5, and just could just play. And when you played, and if you wanted to be a doctor or soldier or whatever it is you used to play at, you could just become it, yeah? You just slipped into it effortlessly. You didn't worry about whether it was real or not. When you were out in the country, you just slipped into it. And you were sort of open and responsive to your environment. In the woods or in another house. There's a kind of playfulness. And we're going to imagine that we've got a kind of secondary breath that goes along and is supported by our normal breath. So it's always supported by our normal breath. And breathing in, breathing out. And we're going to imagine that we can also breathe through the soles of our feet. As we breathe in, imagine breathing in through the soles of your feet. And as you breathe out, imagine that you're also breathing out through the soles of your feet. Notice the landscape of the soles of the feet, a little landscape all of our own, aren't they? Not surprising, because they have a natural love and affinity with the land. And breathing in, aware of the soles of your feet, and breathing out, aware of the soles of your feet. Between the toes and the toes themselves, the heel, the size of the foot, breathing in, breathing out, being aware of your feet. So there's more subtle breath. The whole body breathes. We Just quite casually, quite casually, quite playfully, we just start drawing up the breath into the ankles and releasing down from the ankles. Nothing's happening, we're just imagining. From the ankles into the lower legs, elegant shin bones, shapely calves, breathing in, breathing out, and on the out breath let them release as if they trust the world, as they do, let them trust the world. Let them trust the earth to hold them. Breathing in, breathing out. Nice soft face as we do this. You're not trying, you're just playing. Bone in the skin, hairs, the flesh, and the muscle, and the tendons. In the blood, breathing in, breathing out. Everything's breathing in the lower legs. They love to breathe, your body loves to breathe. This is what it does. Much more than thinking or worrying or planning. It breathes, it loves to breathe. Let it breathe. Into the knees, those stone knees, those knees of stone. Mechanism, medieval knee of yours. And up into the big legs, those big muscles and big bones, those powerful upper leg. And on the out breath, just letting it go, letting it go, letting it go. What would it be like not to hold on anymore? Still breathing up through the soles of the feet, the ankles, the lower legs, into the pool of the knees and into those big muscles and bones. And then coming into the pelvis, through the buttocks there. Hips and the pelvis, pelvic floor. And we could spend a long, long time with this, but we're not going to do that tonight because we're going to put it all together. So this is this meditation is called Remembering the Body. We're remembering the body through the breath. This is remembering the body through the breath. We're remembering the legs by breathing them. And we're remembering them to the hips, into the pelvis. And we're going to draw together at the dātē and at the hara. So this is imagined a couple of finger whips below the navel in front of the spine, just in front of the spine. We're imagining now breathing up from the feet all the way up through the legs to the hara, and then releasing down from the hara in the opposite direction. So breathing in, remembering the legs, and breathing out, remembering the legs. Breathing in, remembering the legs, and breathing out. And in your legs, full of memory, full of image, full of your history, when you were a little baby, when you were a little child running, learning to walk, in the woods, in different countries. What do your feet and your legs remember as you remember them? Okay, so we're going to leave them just breathing away nicely on their own. They're still up to whatever they're up to. They're still breathing in and breathing out. And we're going to remember the arms. And we do this by starting to breathe through the palms. Breathing in through the palms and breathing out through the palms. Fingers and the fingertips and under the nails and the knuckles. Those lovely hands of yours. What can they tell you? Your whole life is written in them, isn't it? Webs between the fingers, back of the hand, don't forget the thumbs. Some sense of appreciation for the hands, perhaps. Even today, no doubt, they've washed you and fed you, dressed you. A lifetime of expressing you in the world. And up through the wrists, into the forearms. Breathing in and breathing out. Remembering the hands and the wrists, those delicate bones. Hands and the lower arms, into the hinges of the elbows there. And up into the upper arms. Hands to the shoulders. And then we're going to draw in to the torso itself. So what happens here is up to you, but we're going to draw down to the heart. So we're going to be breathing from the hands to the heart. And just notice how the energy moves as it comes through the shoulders. It might fan out behind the scapula there, behind the collarbone and breastbone. Just notice what it does as you imagine drawing it down to the heart and releasing from the heart, and it will reverse direction, so from the heart to the hand. So this is a natural connection, energetically speaking, and emotionally speaking, and imaginatively speaking. There's a natural connection between the hands and the heart. The hands express the heart in tenderness and in anger, in creativity and love. The hands express the heart. In healing, and caring. Tending, so breathing in. So we're doing this all rather too quickly, but we're a bit short of time, so we'll just have to just get some idea. So breathing from the hands to the heart and back out, and the heart, don't worry too much about the location of the heart being anatomically correct. You know. That's not so important, really. Okay, so we're going to let them carry on their own, breathing away nicely. And we're going to do the central channel. So this is from the root to the crown. And we could draw down from above, but we're just going to draw up. We'll just do it in one direction, unless it naturally occurs to you in the both directions, which it can sometimes. But we're just, for simplicity, we'll just do it. So we're going to start at the root, so this is the perineum between the anus and the sexual organs there. And we're going to imagine the central channel running just in front. Sometimes it's synonymous with the spine, but more often it's imagined just running in front of the spine. The spine itself is a lot deeper set in the body than we normally imagine. So this channel is through the core of the body, really. So if you drop the line from the crown of the head, a plumb line from the crown, and it could go through the body, that would be where we're imagining this channel, which you might imagine as a kind of well, or a shaft of light, or energetic openness in the body. So as we breathe, and we're just going to explore drawing up from the root. So let's draw up first, just an inch or so. So in most systems, sometimes the two lower chakras get kind of melded together, particularly in some of the Buddhist tantra actually. In most systems, you've got two chakras down there. You've got the root and then the sexual organs. I'm just drawing up a few inches to start with. And releasing down. And you can release down into the earth itself, however far down. And you're drawing up from the earth. So we're drawing up earth energy here. We're drawing up the moist, stable, deep energy of the earth. Give rise to all life, really. It comes from earth. You come from earth. This is you. You're energetically earth, really. You're mixed, but that's the more substantial part of you is earth. Drawing up, and we can draw up now from the root, coming up towards the navel. And releasing down. So it's a light imagining, a playful imagining, done kind of at the corner of the eye, or the corner of the mind in a way. Not done with your rational ego. Yeah. Your ego will try to appropriate it. But just don't take too much notice of that. Yeah. It's that horrible self-conscious part of you that always deciding whether things are right or wrong, and good and bad, and correct and incorrect. It's that playful, light part of you. And then up, we're going to go start drawing up beyond towards the heart. It's quite a long way, isn't it? Sometimes our hearts are quite a long way from the earth, quite separated from what's below. They really want that nourishment from underneath, that rich, deep nourishment of the earth. Things as they really are down there. Not all neat and conceptual, but dark and mysterious, unknowable, juicy and moist, a little bit dangerous and a little bit wild down there. To the heart. Releasing down, still using your normal breath to sort of give stability to the whole thing. From the heart to the throat. Throat's always very interesting to come into the throat with a bit of awareness. Very interesting. We could say a lot about the throat, but we won't. Leave the poor old throat alone. And up to the brow and to the crown. And the crown we imagine is sort of open to the sky. And you might notice perhaps on the out-breath that as the energy goes back down, it draws in light in the spaciousness and the sky energy into the body. You might like to imagine the sky energy coming down, earth energy coming up, and there's a meet in the heart there. Got our central channel, and we're going to now remember our legs. We're feeding in at the hara into the central channel, and then we're going to remember our arms that are feeding in at the heart to the central channel. And there you are, the whole of you remembered, put back together. And we'll just sit for a few minutes, just breathing in, breathing out, remembering ourselves. Slowly let go of any effort at all. So whatever's happening, it's just happening by itself. You're not trying. trying to make it happen, you're not trying to stop it happening. It's not happening, it's not happening, it's fine. Anyway, what the hell's meant to be happening? Who knows? Just let it be. It's just breathing, because that's what the body does, it just breathes. And it loves to breathe, and it loves to be remembered. And it so loves to be in this world. I was thinking about tonight, this poem came to mind. This is Gunnar Ekloth's Aya Asma. Aya Asma is a cult of a healing well. A cult of a healing well. You can imagine the well of your body. Black image, framed in silver, worn to shreds by kisses. The black image, framed in silver, worn to shreds by kisses. All around the image, the white silver, worn to shreds by kisses. The very metal, worn to shreds by kisses. Framed in metal, the black image, worn to shreds by kisses. Oh, the darkness, worn to shreds by kisses. Oh, the darkness in our eyes, worn to shreds by kisses. Kisses. All we wished for, worn to shreds by kisses. All we never wished for, kissed and worn to shreds by kisses. All we escaped, worn to shreds by kisses. All we wish for, kissed, and kissed again.